Hi, how are you guys? Nice to see you.
Hey.
Here we are.
Good to see familiar faces.
Oh my God. I have to say, it is haunting to be reading about this, having lived through the run-up to the war in Iraq, I have to tell you.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another installment of your favorite Russ Finkelstein podcast, the New Yorker Political Scene Scene. We have a lot to talk about today, so I'm not going to lollygag around too much here. But remember a few weeks ago on the last episode of this show, I said I looked forward to a moment later this summer when I might have more time to focus on this podcast and make it a regular thing. Well, lucky for you, that moment has come. So look forward to more frequent installments of the New Yorker Political Scene Scene, and please tell your friends and enemies too. The more momentum I get here, the more time and energy I'll be putting into this. So if you like what you hear, let me know and let everyone else know as well. With that out of the way, let's dive right into today's rather heavy and frankly terrifying topic, Israel and the United States' war with Iran.
It's worth stepping back and having a conversation that, you know, stands up almost regardless. And that's about how we got to this moment. Because it feels for me, as someone who's been watching the intersection of Washington and the world over the last few decades, that this is the moment we've been talking about and anticipating literally for almost a couple decades.
As Susan Glasser put it there, this is a pivotal moment for the world, for the United States, and perhaps most importantly, for the hosts of the New Yorker political scene themselves. The U.S.'s conflict with Iran is something that has shaped the careers of Evan Osno, Susan Glasser, and Jane Mayer alike. So what do they have to say about it? Well, for starters, despite clearly knowing better, they frame this conflict as one that began in 1979 with the Iranian Revolution and the birth of the Islamic Republic. And folks, I am not an Iran expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I do know enough to say that framing it that way is kind of like saying that the conflict between Israel and Palestine started on October 7th. And again, these guys definitely know better. But anyway, here we go.
Jane, Evan, you know, I think made the point going back to the very beginning, really, of your incredible run reporting in Washington. It's the Iranian Revolution overhang. It's literally been with you your entire journalism career.
It's been background music, more or less. When I first came to Washington as an intern for Time magazine, there was still the Shah on the throne in Iran, and then he was overthrown, and there was suddenly champagne being poured from the Iranian embassy out into the streets, and, you know, the new regime came in, and the Islamists took over.
So for those of you who may not know, the Shah was basically the monarch of Iran, who was ruling the country with basically no democratic checks at that point, because the democratically elected prime minister, Mohammad Mossadegh, was overthrown in a coup that was supported by the CIA in order to consolidate power around the Shah. It was just one of many examples of the United States undermining democracy in the most literal sense, and also to prevent the nationalization of Iran's oil. I mention this because you're going to now hear a lot about the decisions and posture of Iran since the Islamic Revolution. But it's important, I think, to understand what the impetus of the revolution was in the first place, and why there would be popular support for an anti-imperialist, anti-American political movement in Iran in the late 70s. They didn't just start chanting death to America because they hate cheeseburgers and baseball. The revolution defined itself in opposition to the United States, the same way our revolution defined itself in opposition to England. We just had protests across this country called No Kings. Why? Because the American revolutionary spirit was born out of an opposition to the unjust influence of the British monarchy. Can you imagine what it would sound like to hear an Englishman today say, "Hey guys, I find it reprehensible that you're denouncing kings. We love our king and think his rule is enshrined by the will of God." Or whatever the fuck the actual justification for their silly little monarchy is in the first place. If there is an Englishman who wants to wag his finger about me saying this, he can go fuck himself. And if you put yourself in the place of Iranians who believed in democracy in the 1970s, it is pretty understandable why you might, after what you've been through for decades at that point, want to chant death to America.
And a few years later, I was in Beirut in 1983 when a proxy of Iran with Hezbollah came and blew up the Marine barracks. And there I was standing there seeing, you know, 250 or so Marines were killed then. But I have to say, what was the response of the United States then? Reagan was president. He withdrew the Marines and a little while later invaded Grenada, the island in the Caribbean. I mean, it was not as if we were at war ourselves with Iran. It was more like they kept hitting Israel. They kept hitting our allies. They may have been hitting us, but we did not retaliate.
I'm glad Jane brought this up here, because Iran being behind the killings of 241 American service members, mostly Marines, in Lebanon, is something you'll often hear as the justification for why the U.S. should bomb Iran. Again, there's some missing context in Jane's framing that is important. For example, like why there were hundreds of Marines stationed in Lebanon in the first place. If you really want to understand this, you should go back and listen to episode 15 of this show, What is Lebanon?, with my friend, Lebanese journalist and author Dalal Mawad, where we get into the history of the Lebanese Civil War, as well as the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon. But for the sake of this conversation, the important thing to know, the 1983 attack on the Marines was carried out about a year after the Sabra and Shatila massacres, in which thousands of Palestinian civilians and militants alike were slaughtered in refugee camps by Christian militias with the support of Israel. So you had American Marines sent into a brutal civil war to tip the scales in favor of Israel, who were then attacked by its rightful enemies. I'm not defending the attack that killed those Marines, but it is the kind of thing that happens to soldiers in a war, unfortunately. And contrary to Jane's point here about Reagan choosing not to retaliate for Iran's deadly attack on the Marines, this is just one example, but I think it's illustrative of a larger dynamic between the U.S. and post-revolution Iran. I'm reading now from a 2013 article in Foreign Policy magazine written by Shane Harris and Matthew M. Aide. The headline is, CIA files prove that America helped Saddam as he gassed Iran. The U.S. knew Hussein was launching some of the worst chemical weapons attacks in history and still gave him a hand. In 1988, during the waning days of Iraq's war with Iran, the United States learned through satellite imagery that Iran was about to gain a major strategic advantage by exploiting a hole in Iraqi defenses. U.S. intelligence officials conveyed the location of the Iranian troops to Iraq, fully aware that Hussein's military would attack with chemical weapons, including sarin, a lethal nerve agent. The Iraqis used mustard gas and sarin prior to four major offensives in early 1988 that relied on U.S. satellite imagery, maps, and other intelligence. These attacks helped to tilt the war in Iraq's favor and bring Iran to the negotiating table, and they ensured that the Reagan administration's longstanding policy of securing an Iraqi victory would succeed. But they were also the last in a series of chemical strikes stretching back several years that the Reagan administration knew about and didn't disclose. According to recently declassified CIA documents and interviews with former intelligence officials, the U.S. had firm evidence of Iraqi chemical attacks beginning in 1983. The Reagan administration decided it was better to let the attacks continue if they might turn the tide of the war. The use of chemical weapons in war is banned under the Geneva Protocol of 1925, which states that parties will exert every effort to induce other states to accede to the agreement. Iraq never ratified the protocol. The United States did in 1975. And a bit more context is provided in this New York Times article, which was written in 2014 and describes the harm that those same chemical weapons did to U.S. troops during the second Iraq War, which we're going to get into a bit later. Quote, Western nations, some eager to contain Iran's Islamic Revolutionary State after the American hostage crisis from 1979 to 1981, lent Iraq support. With remarkable speed, Iraq built a program with equipment and precursors purchased from companies in an extraordinary array of countries, eventually including the United States, according to its confidential declarations. Iraq produced 10 metric tons of mustard blister agent in 1981. By 1987, its production had grown 90-fold, with the late war output aided by two American companies that provided hundreds of tons of theodiglycol, a mustard agent precursor. Chanting death to America is one thing. Helping Saddam Hussein to manufacture and use chemical weapons on soldiers and civilians alike is another story entirely. But I digress.
I think there's two factors that have changed pretty radically since Reagan's time. Obviously, the first is Iran's nuclear aspirations and their development not only of ballistic missile technology that enables them to rain down, in theory, destruction on Israel, which they have committed to as a sort of guiding principle.
Is it not also worth considering that Iran might be looking around and saying, why is Kim Jong-un still in power in North Korea? while Saddam Hussein and Muammar Gaddafi were deposed and killed. It would seem that having nuclear weapons, or at least the threat that you could quickly get them if you needed to, is a huge deterrence against foreign military intervention. Just saying.
And then we've never recovered from the trauma, the collective national trauma of the hostage crisis in the immediate aftermath of the Iranian Revolution. We have pursued a strategy of not just containment of Iran, but essentially that has sort of warped and distorted the development of all geopolitics in the Middle East since then, because we've never been able to normalize our relationship with Iran.
Well, we certainly came a lot closer than we ever have in normalizing relations with Iran with Barack Obama's biggest international achievement, the JCPOA, which eased sanctions on Iran in exchange for inspections of their nuclear sites and limits on enrichment. Yes, the nuclear deal had its limits and its expiration date, as the war hawks love to point out, but it was a path to a diplomatic relationship that would be better equipped to adjust the deal, and I think more importantly, lead to the economic growth and development in Iran that would likely create a more fertile political environment for progressives and reformers there. But Donald Trump decided to unilaterally withdraw from that deal during his first presidency, which is as big of a reason why we're in this mess now as any. Regardless, to further understand or perhaps obfuscate Iran's motives, the host of The Political Scene now bring in Iran expert Karim Sajapour to help us better understand how to think about all of this.
One of the questions I have for Karim and for both of you is, do we think that Prime Minister Netanyahu's decision here is primarily a decision about Iran and how close they are to a nuclear breakout? Or is it in some ways a decision about Donald Trump and that this is his moment and that Trump, no matter how reluctant, would in the end actually have to go along with Israel in this war? I'm fascinated by the calculus that led us to this moment.
So I'll just jump in here and say, clearly Netanyahu's decision to launch a full-scale bombing war against Iran was motivated by his own personal political interests. That's it. Full stop. There was a lot of discussion leading up to the U.S. bombing of Iran about a new finding by the International Atomic Energy Agency report from a few weeks ago that said that Iran had a bunch of uranium that had been enriched to about 60%, and that this represented a dramatic increase in their enriched uranium stockpile. Basically, uranium needs to be enriched to 90% in order for it to be used in a nuclear weapon. Interestingly enough, Iran is a party to the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which is why it's subject to inspection and regulation by the International Atomic Energy Agency in the first place. You know who's not party to that treaty, by the way? Israel. And you know who is the only country in the Middle East with nuclear weapons? Oh, it's the country that's bombed 5 of its neighbors in the past 2 years. Also, Israel. So to keep it all straight, Israel is accusing Iran of being a threat to regional and global peace and stability, but it won't even acknowledge that it has nuclear weapons or subject itself to the required inspections as are required by international law. Anyway, one of CNN's resident war hawks, Fareed Zakaria, asked the director general of the IAEA about Israel's allegations about Iran's nuclear program over the weekend, and he denied that the agency had any evidence that Iran was working towards obtaining a nuclear weapon.
Let me ask you about the trigger for these American attacks, or indeed the Israeli attacks. The director of national intelligence testified that Iran had not made a decision to weaponize its nuclear energy program, and that they were confident that the decision made in 2003 not to weaponize had not been overruled. The president said that he believed they were moving towards nuclear weapons. From what you can tell, what was the situation? Was Iran beginning to weaponize its program?
We didn't have any indication to that effect. And this is something I must point out, Fareed, it's very important, because there has been a lot of speculation about what the IAEA said or what it didn't say, even before this military operation started. We very clearly indicated in my last report to the Board of Governors of the IAEA, I indicated very clearly that we did not have elements to prove that Iran had a plan or a systematic effort towards a nuclear weapon.
Okay, so that's the backdrop here. let's see how the senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment, Karim Sajapour, explains Israel's actions to our intrepid hosts.
I think Netanyahu's sense of urgency was driven by three factors. Number one, you know, Iran had been inching towards nuclear weapons capability. I don't believe that they were on the verge of it, as Netanyahu and later Trump alleged, but certainly they were dangerously close to that zone. Second, as you probably have talked about before, last fall, Israel destroyed Iran's air defense systems, and they believed that they had a limited amount of time to act again against Iran before Iran was able to rebuild those air defense systems. But most importantly, Prime Minister Netanyahu implicitly didn't trust President Trump and Steve Witkoff and doing negotiations with Iran. He believed that Trump was capable of doing a deal with Iran that would limit its program, limit its nuclear program, but not eliminate it, much like the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal, which President Obama signed. And so I think that was probably the most significant of those three factors.
So to unpack what he's saying there, Sajapour thinks that Netanyahu went on this bombing campaign in Iran, targeting their nuclear sites, but also killing hundreds of people, including civilians, essentially to disrupt the negotiations between Donald Trump and the Iranian regime that could lead to cooling of relations between Iran and the West. Netanyahu is fundamentally opposed to that idea. Just keep that in mind.
I think if the dust settles and they manage to stay in power, this regime manages to stay intact, I think they're no longer going to be taking a deliberate approach towards nuclear weapons. I think they will have a strong impetus to try to get one as quickly as possible. So that means that their subterranean nuclear enrichment, uranium enrichment facility in Fordo, which was built half a mile underground, if you don't take that out or severely damage it, that's where they could advance, obviously, their weapons ambitions.
Okay, so this interview was recorded before the U.S. bombed the very sites that he's discussing here. But I just want to hone in on the logic, because it kind of undergirds the analysis from the political scene hosts and a lot of American pundits who have weighed in on this subject, which is a sort of inevitability of the U.S. bombing Iran. What Sajapour is saying is, Netanyahu wanted to destroy a possible diplomatic resolution to the long-standing tensions between the U.S. and Iran. And because Israel started this bombing campaign in Iran, we need to now make sure to destroy Iran's nuclear program entirely. Otherwise, they might try to quickly get a nuclear weapon and use it because they are so angry. Just think about that for a second. The United States has the most powerful military in the world. And the logic here is, right or wrong, Israel instigated this war, so we have no choice but to get involved on their side. This would be like if you had a small but very aggressive friend who is always starting fights with people, and one day he sucker punches some very big guy on the street, and the guy is so furious, so you bash him to death with a shovel because, you say, you had no choice given how provoked and dangerous he became after he was punched in the face for no reason.
And as it's been talked about a lot, that facility is something that Israel likely can't destroy. It would require U.S. B-52 and U.S. bunker busters.
Hard to emphasize this enough, but Israel started this war with Iran knowing full well that they couldn't destroy Iran's nuclear sites without a U.S. intervention. Just think of that. They're so confident we will back them up despite what sort of trouble they get into that they can pick a fight they know they can't win without us. Just insane.
In some ways, it seems from a critical point of view then that Israel, to some extent, entrapped Trump into having to take action because he was in the midst of negotiations, whether or not Netanyahu trusted them or not. But these negotiations were cut off by Israel, which has now put the United States in a position of having to act or else face potentially an angrier Iran that still has nuclear weapons and more of a motive for using them. In some ways, Israel is really driving this. Is this in the interests of the United States? It's certainly in the interests of Israel, but is it in the interests of the United States as you see it?
Great question.
You know, the reality is that had Trump given Netanyahu a firm red light continued to give him a firm red light, that as he had in the past, and said, you know, absolutely not. We're in the midst of these negotiations. I want to see them through. I don't think Prime Minister Netanyahu would have done this. But I think what essentially happened over the last couple of months is this combination of Netanyahu's insistence and persistence, coupled with Ayatollah Khamenei's defiance.
Defiance is one way to put it. You might also say that Iran has been incredibly restrained since October 7th. Israel has repeatedly bombed Iran. Iran has shot missiles back, but until this recent round of fighting, those attacks have mostly been symbolic. Israel went on a full-scale assault against Hezbollah in Lebanon, one of Iran's biggest allies in the region. Iran mostly stayed out of it. Israel assassinated Hamas's leader, Ismail Haniyeh, in Iran's capital. Iran's response was widely considered to be measured because they were ultimately hoping to find a way to avoid a direct conflict with Israel and the United States. A direct war with Israel is not in the interest of Iran's leadership unless they are forced into such a war, which is exactly what Benjamin Netanyahu is trying to do now. I am not here to defend the Iranian regime. I think they have done and do some atrocious things. But I think it's important to remember that recent history has shown us that ultimately wars are perpetuated by people who have an interest in those wars. And in this case, I don't see how any objective observer could say that Iran has an interest in a war with the United States or with Israel.
You've said over the last few days, I think really important point is that this could either entrench the regime or lead to its end. There is a way in which this could really go in such a wild variety of directions. I wonder if you would share with us what actually concerns you most. What is the scenario here that you are worried about, that you think that the decision makers and ultimately the public that will bear the consequences for this in so many countries, what should we be thinking about that is perhaps not getting enough attention and recognition at the highest levels?
Well, I remember our friend Tom Friedman,
Bombocat,
on the eve of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, said that the best place from which to understand this war is not Washington or Kyiv or Moscow, but it's inside Putin's head. And, you know, I think we're in a scenario now where what is going to drive events is not the national interests of the United States or the national interests of Iran, but this duel between these two men, 79-year-old Donald Trump and 86-year-old Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei.
What about the guy who started this war with Iran and who dog-walked Donald Trump into it in the first place, Benjamin Netanyahu? It would seem like Netanyahu is actually the one steering the ship here, not Trump or Khamenei. But that is a tough point to hammer on if you work in the framework of American institutions and publications that believe in and promote Israel's supremacy and U.S. global hegemony.
And then there's the impact that this has on Iran internally. People are still talking in some ways about the 1953 coup against Prime Minister Mossadegh, right? You know, this is an event which could play in Iranian domestic politics in a negative way for decades to come. I think that there are risks to inaction. There are certainly risks to inaction right now, given the situation we find ourselves in, which is if the regime remains intact and that Fordo facility remains intact, you could have an angry, revanchist regime with a strong desire to get nuclear weapons. That's not good for American interests. It's not good for our allies. But the risks to action are much more difficult to assess.
Unfortunately, we'll never know the risks of that inaction, because between when this interview was recorded and now, the U.S. did bomb those nuclear sites. So stand by, I guess, on how that impacts Iran's future, including its domestic political future. But suffice it to say, bombing a country hasn't, in recent years, proven to be a good way to get that country's leader or people to like you.
I think it's also important to keep in mind some of the points he made about the role of Iran's population. You know, it's never a monolith, but there is and has been a lot of antipathy towards the regime. And yet there is also this deep-seated memory of foreign intervention in Iran, the dislodging of a democratically elected leader, and how that in its own way could turn the public against an effort to dislodge the regime. That's just one of the as Karim's put it so well, one of the unknown unknowns, you know, quoting Donald Rumsfeld from the run-up to the war in Iraq. That is a haunting analogy for us to be aware of today, which is to say that, you know, it all looks so clean when you're examining an option set in the preamble. And then afterwards, you say, how could we have not realized that this would produce consequences X, Y, and Z? I'm kind of bracing for the reality that we may be living right now in the run-up to an event that could really be reverberating through our lives for years.
So that clip is the last one I have from this episode of The New Yorker's Political Scene. But out of curiosity, I went back and listened to an episode from March of 2023 that marked the 20th anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. As I've mentioned before on this program, that war was one of the defining moments of my political formation. I remember thinking the war was wrong and based on bullshit long before the bomb started flying, when the George W. Bush administration was trying to justify invading Iraq after 9/11. And so I thought it would be fun to include, as a sort of addendum here, some of the reflections of Evan Osnos, Susan Glasser, and Jane Mayer to that war and what, if anything, it taught them. So here's some of those clips, which I think are an illuminating look at how the American media has largely approached covering America's wars. Let's go now to Kuwait in the year 2003.
Well, Evan, you know, I'm thinking about how you and I met each other, which was basically in Kuwait while waiting for this war to start. And that's where I was on the day the war started, in Kuwait at the what became the headquarters hotel of the U.S. military for the war. I will never forget sitting there on the breakfast cafe, which was right on the sand. You know, there were like literally like Gurkhas marching, you know, across the sand from the British military there. We were sitting there and we were with our mutual friend, Ed Gargan, a legendary correspondent. And he was a link to the Vietnam era. And he had a very different perspective on the war. He was also sort of a prankster. And he's sitting there, and these young American soldiers sit down next to us in full combat regalia, which was extremely surreal. And Ed starts saying, give me a Q. Give me a U. Give me an A. Give me a G. And he spells out quagmire.
Wow.
And I was like, Ed, you're going to get us in big trouble. You know, those people have guns sitting next to us. What are you talking about? And the truth is that I didn't really see it. I wasn't convinced. And, you know, the Iraq war was many things, but it also was sort of a death of innocence and a sort of naivete that I think I and many people had about, you know, that the U.S. government can't possibly be this wrong. And of course, they turned out in many assumptions to be that wrong.
Susan Glasser was, I guess, born in 1969. So she was only 5 or 6 years old when the Vietnam War ended. But didn't she like read about it or something? She used to work at the Washington Post. Did she not hear about the Pentagon Papers? Honestly, though, I do appreciate her candor in admitting this because it's frankly quite embarrassing.
The salient memory I have was at a then Redskins football game. And I was in the bleachers with the top brass of the Washington Post. And I asked them, what do you think? It was right on the eve of the invasion. And I won't name names, but they said, the one thing we know is the Iraqi people are going to be so happy when we come in. They're going to be dancing. Do you remember there was going to be a cakewalk? It was going to be just so much excitement, and we were rescuing them, and there was this incredible rah-rah spirit in Washington that we were the good guys going to save, you know, bring democracy to the heathens, basically, and liberate the Iraqis. And they were absolutely certain this was the right thing to do at the top of the Washington Post.
Again, an insane admission. And I applaud Jane Mayer for saying all of this 20 years later. But fucking A, man.
I ran right into the buzzsaw of that false expectation literally on the first day of the war. And I just, before we came here, I just reread the story that I did, because what happened after breakfast in the hotel is that we decided we were supposed to be the unembedded journalists. The unilateral journalists is what they called us.
Right.
We were not going to be with the American military. Our job was to go see the Iraqi people who were going to be greeting us with flowers and parades and welcoming their liberators. And so I and a group of other correspondents, we literally had rental cars from the Kuwait airport, and we assembled our own little mini convoy, and we decided basically one day into the war we were going to try to drive up to the border and drive on our own across the border so that we could report on the liberation that we would surely see. Well, after various adventures, leaving in the middle of the night, and we snuck across the border, we made it to the first town on the border, which is called Safwan. And you know, Jane, not only was there no parades, but we were shocked to find children stoning the military vehicles, crowds of anxious, unhappy people screaming. They were screaming for water and electricity. And that became actually the mantra for the entire time that I was in reporting in southern Iraq for the next couple of months. Water and electricity. They were angry. They felt betrayed. These were Shiites who felt that George H.W. Bush had encouraged them to rise up against Saddam Hussein and then had not been there when they did so. Many of them said they had family members who were killed. And we saw that there was no plan.
Yeah.
That the U.S. just had no idea what it was doing. And the headline that the Washington Post put on that story was U.S. military brings instability in its wake. And actually, at the end of the day, it was so unsafe, and a film crew drove down the road toward Basra and was shot, a British film crew. We retreated back across the border, and we stayed there for the next couple weeks.
So what Susan is describing here is commonly referred to as parachute journalism, because you're essentially parachuting into a situation you have basically no context for. Luckily, there has been somewhat of a reckoning about this type of reporting, or at least there was when I was in journalism school about a decade ago. But essentially, it usually just perpetuates a superficial understanding of something as complex as a war, as well as the reporter's own stereotypes and assumptions. I would love for Susan Glasser to go speak with young journalism students about this very experience, because it's basically a case study on what not to do as a foreign reporter covering a war. An Iraqi journalist, or say, a Western journalist who lives in Iraq or the region, might have known better and would not have been completely caught off guard by the dynamics on the ground. But anyway, I do think it's illustrative of how the narratives about U.S. military aggressions can get distorted and perpetuated to American audiences.
So you have this war that is turns out to be launched on essentially false pretenses, right? And that is a shock to the system. And it also reveals a certain hollowness at the core of the American superpower, right? It shows that our military, for all of its extraordinary capabilities, is not really able to provide an all-purpose solution to a geopolitical problem.
Oh, how I wish that this lesson Susan is recounting here in 2023 was still at the tip of her tongue today. And that's ultimately the really maddening thing about listening to the New Yorker political scene. These are smart people. They seem to have an educated understanding of the world and of our politics, but somehow they continue to perpetuate the same flawed logic, the failure to call out current U.S. actions as a part of a long-standing pattern of lies, manipulation, and destruction around the world. These people know they should be skeptical of all of the political narratives coming out of Israel and Washington, but instead, they're just perpetuating a middle-brow narrative that assumes as a given the correct order of things is U.S. global domination. They're first and foremost American exceptionalists. Even when they know better, that knowledge seemingly never makes its way into their analysis. And so I do my best to point this out because it's my belief that the United States really won't be able to deal with any of the very serious problems we face as a country until we truly buck this whole American exceptionalism thing once and for all.
And one of the ways that I hope that it maybe is something we can learn from is for the press, which is to maintain skepticism, particularly when it comes to seeing a sort of a war fever which is sweeping Washington at any particular point. I think it's so important that we really think hard, examine the facts, and go the extra mile.
Hear, hear.
God, I really wish they listened to this. Maybe they do. Does anyone know if maybe they've heard this show before? That would be kind of awesome if they had. Anyways, Thanks again, everybody, for listening. I will hopefully be back next week with another episode of this show, and hopefully, God willing, Zohran Mamdani will be the Democratic nominee for New York City's mayor's race. Inshallah. Keep Zohran in your thoughts and prayers, everyone. Fuck Andrew Cuomo. Shalom.